our indigenous peoples across Turtle Island saw the bear as a very, very close relative. So we watched what they ate. We watched what they did and where they came from. And, you know, you can see that they're almost human-like.
Luana Harper Shirt is a Cree knowledge keeper. She says the bear has much to teach us about courage through motherhood.
She is a beautiful example of a mother. Gentle, stern, get-to-the-point kind of mother. You know, they may look stern, but really they have that heart, that beautiful, loving, nurturing heart that they give out, they extend. You see that in what the bear does for us when we ask for that help.
Spring brings new beginnings. It's a time for renewal, for people and for bears. Luana says it is during this time that some turn to the bear spirit for healing. But they've got to be brave enough to handle her tough love.
Wawashka Makwa, her promise to us is that there's nothing that she cannot heal. She's not a care bearer. She's that one that's, you know, she's listening to you, but her healing may look like something like totally out of left field, but it's like, this is what you've asked for. She'll listen to you, but she's like, you have to make sure you listen to me, you know, listen to what I'm saying, because this is for your own good. This is for, you know, you're asking for this healing. I'm going to give you that.
That means having the courage to hear and apply the lessons that Bear gifts us. Courage is one of the seven sacred teachings, and its teacher is Bear. Tansay, Anine, Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. For generations, the Gitgat people kept the existence of the spirit bear a secret. But when a proposed gas pipeline threatened their territory, Marvin Robinson revealed these special bears to the world to save their habitat.
And once National Geographic had the bear on the cover, yeah, the cat was out of the bag and people started coming. People wrote letters and managed to get the pipeline stopped.
And in Canada's north, the polar bear is revered by Inuit, who use every part of the animal. Vanessa Flowers recently cleaned her first polar bear skin, learned from her grandmother to pass on to future generations.
It's not learning something new. It's just reawakening what's already inside.
Plus, an Anishinaabe culture, the bear is one of their most sacred teachers. Ogimawab Sutherland says the bear was once all-powerful and all-knowing.
Mushkwa, you would teach everybody about medicine. You taught everybody a good way of life.
But soon, that good way of life changed.
And eventually, Mushkwa, he became very angry at the people because of their behavior, because they were greedy and they were awful to each other.
Today, as part of our Sacred Seven series, we look to our bear relatives for their lessons on healing, cultural resurgence, and courage. The Great Bear Rainforest stretches from central BC to southeastern Alaska. This swath of snow-capped mountains and towering coniferous trees is the only place you can find the spirit bear. Spirit bears are a subspecies of the North American black bear, but their fur is a distinct cream color. Marvin Robinson first encountered this unique species nearly 25 years ago. Today, he's known as the Spirit Bear Whisperer. Marvin is Gitgat and the owner of Gitgat Spirit Bear Tours in Hartley Bay, BC. Marvin, welcome to Unreserved.
Yes, thank you.
So tell us, what is a spirit bear?
Well, it's really neat to try and understand. For some unknown reason, like 1 out of 10, I believe, that black bears, there's a recessive gene that comes out 1 in 10, and it comes out white or cream colored.
What do the Gitgat people call a spirit bear?
It's known as Malkskamal, and the word that it was called before Malkskamal is Masala. And that's our old language, and that's what it was referred to before Malkskamal.
And what does Malkskamal mean?
Malkskam is white and all is bear.
Ah, so right in the name.
Yeah.
And how come the spirit bear or the Malkskamal is only found in your territory?
I like they say it's a recessive gene that runs up part of the BC coast and goes inland a little bit as far as Terrace Smithers. I don't know what the reason it is only found in this area, but it's pretty rare for that for sure.
Do you or can you share a traditional story from the Gitgat about the spirit bear?
One of the legends that goes back far to glacial age is that the creator left 1 in 10 black bears white just to remind us of the clean, pristine times when this earth was covered with glacial, for sure.
And why is that an important teaching to know?
Well, we've been lucky enough to share our territory with this bear, and I think it's taught us that we're only sharing it. We don't own, you know, the area, the bears, the wildlife that live there. We just feel like we're left to look after and try and keep the area the same way it was when we found it.
You've been watching and learning about this bear for, you know, over 25 years now. Tell me about the first time you saw one.
Well, it's a real interesting story. I started salmon fishing when I was 16 years old, fishing with my father for a few years, learning it. And I got on another boat and got to fish all over the BC coast, salmon seining and rowan kelp and stuff. And we were fishing down south towards Vancouver, and that was sort of our home base. And in the fall, September, I felt that I wasn't making any more money, and we still had a few weeks of salmon. So I went to my skipper and asked him if it was possible that I go home because we're not making, it's costing me more to be here than what I was making. So he agreed. He only agreed if I agreed to come back out the following year. So I said, okay, and flew up to Prince Rupert from Vancouver. Caught a flight home on a Friday and was with my family there. And Saturday morning come along and my brother was working down the fuel station selling fuel. So I brought a cup of coffee down to him and sat with him for about an hour before the first boat came in. And I thought, oh, geez, he's going to have to go up and down the ramp, you know, how many times today? So I said, I'll go hand the first boat the nozzle. And luck of the draw, you know, it was a guy that wanted to meet our hereditary chief. So I asked him, you know, I could go talk to him and, you know, just a little bit, what is it about? And he said, well, I got a film crew following shortly behind me and we're trying to go film this rare bear called the Kermode bear, in which we call today the spirit bear. So I told him I'll be right back. I'll go up and see the chief and see if he'd want to talk to you. So ran up to the house and the chief told me to bring him up. And I brought him up to the house and I grabbed a cup of coffee, went and watched the news while they were having their meeting at the table. And the chief turned around to me and I married his granddaughter. So, and this is just a day after I got home, spent the first night in Hartley Bay. And the chief turned to me when they were done and he said, Marvin, go pack your bags. You're going to go out with these guys for a few days. And I was like, oh, my God. So I went to my girlfriend at the time and I told her, I said, your dad's just sending me out on a boat with a bunch of strangers. And and she goes, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I can't say no to the chief. But I said, I'm just letting you know, he told me to pack my stuff and go with them. And I said, they're looking for some bear that we're not allowed to talk about. And within an hour after we left the Hartley Bay, we started filming a pack of wolves, and they came within 30 feet of the camera. And the guy that I went with was Wayne McCory. He's a bear biologist. So after seeing this pack of wolves, in my mind, I was thinking, there's no way we're going to see a black bear with a pack of wolves in this bay. So we went up the estuary a little bit more, and we were sitting on the grass, and Wayne sent his dog Lucy to go find a bear. So the dog took off, and he says, well, I don't know if the dog could distinguish between a white bear and a black bear, but we'll just wait and see. So about 45 minutes, the dog was gone, and I seen it come running down the grass, and it looked a lot happier when it was coming back and rolled over beside Wayne. And Wayne said, well, Lucy found a bear, you know, let's go follow her. And he says, not sure what kind of bear, but I know she's pretty happy. It's a bear. So we went, followed the dog up the river, and the dog laid down. So she said, Lucy wants us to stop. So we sat there for about 15 long minutes. And in my mind, I'm going, what are we doing listening to a dog? And I was looking up river and taking a glance down river, and there's nothing. And we could see some salmon in the creek and some salmon that had been fed on. And then all of a sudden, out of the side creek, a big white bear come walking out and crossed the creek and went and caught a fish right out in front of us. And like I say, I was only 19 then, and basically it hooked me. And I've been doing that since.
That's an amazing, epic story. And as you know, you saw this after you listened to the dog, Lucy, and saw this amazing, majestic, rare bear. What were you thinking? What were you feeling in that moment?
I would say it's pretty spiritual. I didn't know. It was almost like my life flashed in front of me. All these questions in my mind going, I know it's a bear, but why is it white? And still today, I haven't had that question answered. And my wife's grandmother, she said, you know, when this coast was covered still with ice, she goes, it probably wouldn't be good to be the color black. You'd stand out. And she goes, I think what we're left was with the trait that when they changed color from going white to black. And, you know, there's an odd time that we get lucky and we get a white one come back. So I think that's really probably more like what happened is when this coast was covered with ice, the bears were white like polar bears. And now we're left with the odd time that one is left white color.
Mm. Well, a good a theory as any, I suppose.
Yeah.
And not to mention, of course, a wonderful story. When did you decide that you wanted to do this, that you wanted to look for the spirit bear and learn about it and then teach others about it?
Well, I still kept on fishing for a few years, but every September I really tried to get out and find, and I had a tough time, you know, when I first started, but there was a few sailboat tourism companies that were working in the territory. So I got lucky and got a month's job with some of these sailboats and got to go on their boats with them and talk about the territory. And if we're lucky, we got to see a spirit bear. So that's where I really started. Then I got lucky and secured an October job with a lodge that was in our territory called King Pacific Lodge. And basically, I just moved down there for 5 days a week at the lodge and just took people out to see the bear. And that's where I really started full time saying, you know, I want to do this and start up a company of my own.
That's amazing. Does it feel a little bit like destiny, you know, from the time you walked into that hereditary chief's kitchen and he was like, you're going to do this?
Oh, yes. I don't know if he knew what he was doing at the time. Before he passed away, he told me that, you know, I want you to look after this rare bear.
Amazing. That's a huge responsibility. What did it feel like when that was bestowed upon you?
Well, it we had a bunch of photographers come to the community when we had the threat of Enbridge oil and tankers coming through our territory. So we were really lucky to have, it's called the ILCP, International League of Conservation Photographers, came into Hartley Bay for 10 days and they just did rapid photography. And there was probably 10 to 15 photographers, even from other areas. We had boats coming in and volunteering their time for the 10 days to get these guys out. And basically they just took rapid photography of what was at risk if oil tankers were to travel up the Douglas Channel. And, you know, this bear basically was used to really help put the nail in the coffin on that one for sure.
So in many ways, the spirit bear sort of led the protection of your territory.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
Earlier, you had mentioned that there was a period of time when the spirit bear's existence was kept a secret. You weren't allowed to talk about it, as you said earlier. Why were the bear's existence kept a secret?
Well, I think it's probably during right from the whole fur trade and stuff, like the whole BC coast. I remember hearing my father talk, and he would go trapping and hunting and stuff. And right from there, I believe that's probably when the hush was put on this rare bear that we got to keep it a secret.
So the concern was that these bears would be hunted, perhaps, and they're already very rare.
Yeah, really, that's the biggest thing.
Did the pipeline play a role in that, or what made the community want to then share the existence of the spirit bear?
This was the start of it. Paul Nicklin was coming up to shoot some stuff for the cover of National Geographic, and I had taken him out to one of my special places, and I called it a nursery for the spirit bears. And I've got some photos. I look back at some of my photos and I go, Jesus, I had these bears right in front of me, you know, spirit bear cubs. And so it was a really special place. And he was the first one that I took to this special place. And we were sitting up there and I was sitting with him when he first got to photograph one of the bears by a waterfall. Me and him were sitting there talking. He said, Marvin, he said, if you want to save Kitgat territory, he said, you got to start taking people here so they get to see what we're seeing today. And once National Geographic had the bear on the cover, yeah, the cat was out of the bag and people started coming. People wrote letters and managed to get the pipeline at the time stopped.
More like the bear is out of the woods.
Yeah.
How well do you know the bears in your area?
Like I say, I've been doing this for a little over 25 years, and bears out in the wild, they get to live for about 20 years. So one of the ones we named Ma'a, in our language, that means mother. And that was what everybody called my grandmother. And she totally fit the description of this spirit bear. For some reason, this one creek has these smaller, and I don't know if it's food, why, but they seem to have a little bit shorter legs. They're lower to the ground. And to me, it's almost like a little bit different of a bear. And that's how my grandmother was. She wasn't tall, but she was tough. And yeah, she basically brought us up, and with my parents that lived with us. So it was my niece, Jolene, that when we were out at one of the first times she got to see her, I hadn't named her yet. And it was my niece that said, you know, why don't we call this one Ma? And right away, I related to the size and stuff. And all bears are different, I believe.
Yeah. And how do people react, like, when they encounter a spirit bear? What kinds of things have people said, or how have they reacted?
Yeah, one of my best trips was years ago when I was guiding with King Pacific, and one of my friends from King Pacific, Norm Han, was helping me out, and we were up one river, and we had this elderly lady. She was at the lodge, and So I called Norm on the radio. I said, I got the spirit bear coming down river above me. I said, you want to get the lady up here as quick as you can. So Norm piggybacked her. I bombed down, helped Norm pack her up. And the spirit bear walked by us, and this lady turned to us, and she was crying, and, you know, she was shaking. And it was pretty amazing. I remember the lady, I said, here, let me take the picture for you. So I took her camera, and I started just seeing her shaking. She was so excited, and the adrenaline, and I took her camera from her, and I started shaking myself, and Norm Hahn had to take the camera, and he started shaking, and, you know, we couldn't get a good picture. But after it was done, we were sitting with the lady, and she goes, I can die now. Yeah, and I said, please don't do it up here. That'll be a long pack. But
yeah,
that's how, to me, how spiritual, and to be able to get that kind of reaction with people is pretty cool. And I talked to all my guides, and they all say the same thing. You know, it's one thing to be out there, but to be there the first time somebody gets to lay their eyes on one of these rare bears is pretty cool.
That's beautiful. Marvin, thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, you're welcome.
Marvin Robinson is Git Gat and the owner of Git Gat Spirit Bear Tours in Hartley Bay on the coast of British Columbia. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, as we continue our series on the Sacred Seven, we learn about bear and how these great teachers connect us to our traditions. Later in the show, we visit Hopedale, Nunatsiavut, to the home of Vanessa Flowers, where she wrestles a 7-foot polar bear. Well, sort of.
My brother Nicholas and I, we've cleaned quite a few seal skins, but we had never seen a polar bear being cleaned before. And it was all going pretty good. Everything was good. And then after it was washed, we thought, all right, let's go put it on the frame. This is not going to take too long. It's an easy part. But we decided to do that on the coldest day of the year. And we learned the hard way that you can't do that. The skin was freezing together. It was freezing to the snow. It was freezing to the ice. The rocks were on it. It was just, it was really, really difficult. But it was definitely a live and learn moment.
In just a few minutes, Vanessa's first time cleaning a polar bear skin and how this rare experience helped her pass traditional knowledge to future generations. Taking us there, this year's Juno winner for Traditional Indigenous Artist or Group of the Year is Black Bear Singers for their 2024 album, New Comings. From Black Bear, this is The W.
Hey!
That is the 2025 Juno winning group Black Bear Singers with the W. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. In many Indigenous communities, bear is part of the seven sacred teachings that help us live the good life, or Mino Bima Disawin. Today, we're exploring lessons of courage and the stories of our bear relatives. In Anishinaabe culture, the bear is one of the most sacred. Ogie Mawib Sutherland is an Anishinaabe language and cultural teacher in Minnesota. He says that within the Anishinaabe clan system, different clans offer support to each other because of the unique knowledge they each hold.
Within Anishinaabe Gidudiminonic, our clans, our bloodlines, Duudem clan, when we look at the clan structure, the bear clan, they go seek the fish clan, because the fish clan are the knowledge keepers. They hold a lot of aspects in history about medicine, about way of life. And also the fish clan, they seek the bear to utilize those knowledge.
Part of the Anishinaabe creation story says that bear was born from medicine in the roots of the cedar tree. The bear clan are still known as medicine carriers. And this is one of the stories that Ogie Mawib's clan carries.
Today, I'd like to share the story about Mashqua, the bear, the one that was born from medicine. Born from the roots of the tree known as Gijik. Gijik is the cedar. Mashqua would take care of Wenabuju and his brothers. The firstborn brother is Makshuyush, and Pukshuyush, the secondborn, and Jibai Boos, the ghost rabbit. Each brother had great abilities. Wenabuju had the ability to change into many things, to anything that he saw. And Makshuyush, the older brother, had the ability to turn into a giant, because Makshuyush, he was strong, powerful, he was cunning, he was a great hunter. And Pukshuyush, the other brother, he was a great dancer, you know. He liked to dance. He was very swift, very fast. And Jibai Boos, the ghost rabbit, had the ability to turn into a ghost. That's the reason why they call him Jibai Boos. Jibai means the wandering spirit. And Boos, Hua Boos, for the rabbit. Mashqua, he would teach everybody about medicine. He taught everybody a good way of life. And eventually, Mashqua, he became very angry at the people because of their behavior, because they were greedy and they were awful to each other. And he stopped sharing his knowledge. He stopped being part of Anishinaabe life. So Mashqua, he moved out into the woods, up into the mountains by himself. He lived up there for many years, isolated. People started to get sick, and Wenabuju said, "We need to get that medicine around our uncle's neck." What was around Mashqua's neck was migas, migasuk shells from the water. And these certain shells that Mashqua had were very powerful. So Wenabuju wanted that necklace. So Wenabuju and his brother, they traveled to see Mashqua up into the mountains. And from there, Mashqua, he said no to the brothers. He did not want to share his medicine. The brothers, they had a council with the Anishinaabe people, and Wenabuju told the people the sad news that their uncle no longer wants to share the medicine. So Wenabuju, he pleaded with the Weziok, the animals. Widukawashin, help me. Nungum, help me today. We have to get that medicine. So Wenabuju came up with a plan. So he helped. All the animals came, and all other spirits came, and they fought the uncle that day. Wenabuju had asked his brother, "Hold on to him, and I'll hit him with my war club, and I'll knock him out." and will take the medicine. And from there went a Bujui, took his war club, flying through the air, hit his uncle over the head. However, when Abuju hit his uncle too hard, splitting his head open, the uncle fell into the Great Lakes. His head was bleeding into the water. And we say that when his head split open, his knowledge of medicine and everything went with, and also that Migas that they were trying to get went into the water. And that's how those certain fish were created, like the whitefish. And from there, Magzhuish, being so big and strong, said, "Your uncle, you're too powerful." And Magzhuish, he raised his uncle into the air, and he threw his uncle into the four directions. And that's why today we say we have different types of bears, like the black bear, the brown bear, and also the polar bear. So the bear in their environment, they go out to the lakes and rivers and they eat the fish. They go out there. We say that they're going out there to gain back their knowledge that was taken from them.
Ogimawup Sutherland is a member of Fort Albany First Nation in Northern Ontario. He's an Anishinaabe language and cultural teacher in Minnesota. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, how bears help us keep our traditional practices alive. Polar bears play a critical role in Inuit culture and provide significant cultural and economic benefits to families and communities. This relationship goes beyond just hunting. It's built on mutual respect and a deep understanding of the natural world. Both the Inuit and polar bears share a connection to the land and the sea ice, with the Inuit hunting them for sustenance while also respecting these powerful creatures. When a local Inuk hunter in Hopedale Nunatsiavut harvested a polar bear, Vanessa Flowers leapt at the opportunity to contribute to the preservation of her cultural heritage by cleaning and preserving the skin. Vanessa is Inuk from Hopedale Nunatsiavut, and she's here to tell us what happened next. Vanessa, welcome to Unreserved.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
So take us to the beginning of this experience. What made you want to reach out to this hunter in your community?
Well, it was the weekend that he had the polar bear, and I had been up to the cabin. And when I returned and I saw the pictures on Facebook, the first thing I thought was to reach out to him, because I had never seen a polar bear being cleaned before. And my brother Nicholas and I, we've cleaned quite a few seal skins, but we told ourselves when the opportunity comes up to be able to watch somebody and learn from somebody how to actually clean a polar bear skin, we thought, well, you know, we're going to take this chance. So I messaged him right away and I said, when you clean your polar bear skin, can me and Nick come down and watch? And he said, actually, I'm trying to sell it just as it is. And I said, oh. And he said, do you want to buy it? And I said, well, this is a prime opportunity. So I said, I'll get back to you. And I messaged my brother, and we thought about it, and we thought, you know, this is the perfect opportunity to learn. And we decided to buy the skin from him, and that's how it started. So instead of watching him, he offered it to us, and we were able to clean it together, my brother and I.
What an amazing opportunity. How often does an opportunity like that come up?
I guess once a year, because here in Nunatsiavut, in the communities, there are, to my knowledge, 3 polar bear licenses a year that go to local hunters. So 5 communities total, 15 licenses. So here there were 3, and it was 3 hunters that had their bears here, and they had them all the same weekend, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, so 3 bears came into the community same weekend. It was a great experience, but I would have to say once a year is enough. great experience, but I'd do it again, but once a year, that's enough.
Yeah, I imagine it was a lot of work. Take us through the process. What did you do first?
Yeah, so the first thing, we paid him, and and then we went, my brother went down to his shed and got the bear, and he told us that it would have to be put in our house for 3 days to thaw before we can even start, because it's just so big and all the fat was frozen and needed to be thawed completely. You can't do anything with it when it's frozen. So after 3 days, it was thawed, and then here we have a pretty big back porch. So we spread the skin in the back porch, and lucky for us, it was actually a small bear. It was only 7 foot.
Only,
I know.
What?
I know. It was only 7 foot. We're thinking it must have been a young male. And like other ones that people usually get are usually like 10 feet. So this one was good because it was small and it was good for us to clean for our first time. So we set it all up, got our tools ready. And between my brother and I, we started at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we finished cleaning it at 7, I believe. I think it was 6 or 7 hours cleaning it straight, with a few breaks in between, and then we had to wash the skin in the tub. A lot. Usually, the skin is taken down into the land wash and cleaned with the salt water. But it was way too cold that evening, and we put it in the tub. That's what Ross told us to do, the man we got the polar bear skin from. Washed it in the tub and then hung it up to dry, just the fur side. And that, overall, 8-9 hours. And then the next day, we put it on the frame, which took another hour, 2 hours. So yeah, overall, 10-11 hours of work.
Holy moly, Vanessa, that's so crazy. So I'm just imagining, so this is a frozen fur, not the whole bear. You didn't bring the whole bear in your house.
No, he had the bear, he had it skinned. So we only had the fur, and the fat was on the fur, and he had the carcass.
So you bring it in your house, you thaw it out on your porch, you give it a bath, I guess.
Yeah.
So you would normally take that fur and do it, what did you say, a natural sea wash? Is that what usually would happen?
Yeah, people usually would take it down and let it soak, let it rinse in the seawater. Mm. That's a good way to clean it. But that evening it was too cold, and it was, Ross told us it's fine. He usually washes his in his tub, so yeah.
You must have a very big tub.
No. It was full.
So once you got it thawed, did you have to put it on a frame, or how did you...
The actual cleaning of the fat?
Yeah.
So we were both set up in the porch, and my brother had a board. We call it a matjavik, which is a board for cleaning skins. And he had one and I had one. He started on the head, and the head was the hardest part. It took a long time because the skin is really tough around the head and the neck. So he was working on that. He had the hardest part. And then I started on one of the legs and kind of worked my way down. And the tool that we use an ulu, the woman's knife. And that's what we were using to clean the fat off. And we were told before that polar bears are easier to clean than seals. And it's true. They are easier to clean, but they're way bigger than a seal. So it's still just as hard in a way, because it's the time it takes, right? But it was easier. It just seemed like it was never ending so much. And after 6-7 hours, we had it done.
So we went to Blackfoot territory this past summer, and there was a guy there who does skinning of buffalo.
Oh,
he had it on a frame. Did you have yours on a frame, or help me visualize what was happening here?
Yeah, so when the cleaning, washing, all that was done, what my brother did. He took the skin and then he had to cut holes all along the perimeter of the bear, making little holes with the ulu. And that's what we would reeve the rope through when it went on the frame. So the frame that we had, we have a lot of frames when we clean seal skins, but a polar bear is way bigger, so my brother had to make a custom frame, and he made a 10-foot frame out of sticks. And we put it on there, and basically we just start at the top, start at the head, reeve it through the holes along the perimeter, and go around the sticks and stretch it out. And it was a 7-foot bear, but we were also told by Ross that the skin would stretch about a foot when you put it on. So it was amazing to see, like, we had it in the frame, and then when it was stretched, like, the legs went right to the perimeter. It was like, wow. And then we measured and it was 8 foot. So it stretched a whole foot. It was amazing to see. And yeah, so that's what we did. And it's out by the shed now, and it's been drying for, I think it's been 2 weeks now, and it's frost drying. So when it frost dries, it takes about 4 weeks. So it has to stay out in really cold temperatures, and it'll be really white on the back when it's all done.
Wow, that's amazing. So Vanessa, as you were, you know, cleaning this 7-foot, now 8-foot piece of fur, like, what kind of obstacles did you encounter as you were doing the process?
Yeah, so it was all going pretty good. Everything was good. And then after it was washed, we had it hung up on a stick in our porch with the fur folded over on itself, so the skin was touching each other. And we had it there, and we were going to leave it there for the night. And then the next day, we were going to put it on the frame, because it was too late at that point to put it on the frame. And then the next day, we thought, all right, let's go put it on the frame. This is not going to take too long. It's an easy part. But we decided to do that on the coldest day of the year. Mm. And we learned the hard way that you can't do that. So we brought it out anyway, and it was kind of a disaster, because we started to put it on the frame, but it just instantly froze. The skin was freezing together. It was freezing to the snow. It was freezing to the ice. The rocks were on it. It was just, it was really, really difficult, but it was definitely a live and learn moment. We almost had it on the frame, but it wasn't stretching right because it was frozen. And then Nick said, I got an idea. We're going to take it off. We're going to fold it up, put it in the shed, forget about it for the day, and do it on a warmer day. And as much as it hurt to do that, we had to, and we put it in the shed. And then we were going to wait for a warmer day, but then I said, no, let's try to get it done tomorrow. So then we put the frame in the shed because it was warmer in the shed. But then the frame didn't fit in the shed. So then he had to take the frame apart, and he had to make it smaller just by a few inches. So I took that apart, did that, put it in the shed, brought the skin back in the house for the whole day to thaw out again because it was frozen solid, brought it back in the shed, and then finally it was good to put on the frame. You gotta learn the hard way sometimes, but it worked out in the end, and yeah, it was able to stretch really good when it was thawed in the shed.
Wow, what an ordeal.
Yeah, it was definitely a trying moment. We were pretty frustrated at that point because we had it done. We just wanted to get it on the frame, you know, but we reminded ourselves, you can't rush things. You can't do that. It's not going to work. So we just had to be patient with ourselves and wait and do it the right way. And it worked.
Mm-hmm. How does, you know, doing this, cleaning a polar bear, connects you to your Inuit culture? Is this something that is in your family, or?
Yeah. Wow. So this was our first one, but our grandmother, who's no longer with us, she used to clean polar bear skins. Well, she used to clean seal skins as well, mostly, but she used to clean polar bear skins too for hunters when they would get their bears. And she cleaned quite a few in her day. And so we learned from her, like, sometimes as a child, I would go over to her house in the afternoon and I would just open the door and I would just see like a polar bear claw sticking out. And I was like, oh, she's cleaning a bear today. And then I would go in and like her whole living room was just taken up with a bear, right? And I was like, I'll just come back another time. There's no room to come in. So she would clean polar bear skins. And the fact that she did that, my brother and I also wanted to know how to do that. And we've cleaned quite a few seals, so we kind of already knew a bit about the process of how to do it. So it was because of her that we wanted to do it too.
What were you thinking as you cleaned this skin and then, you know, remembered that your grandmother used to do this?
Honestly, the first thing I thought was, wow, she used to clean this by herself. Like, it took my brother and I 7 hours for a 7-foot bear, and she would have bigger ones than that, and she would clean those. I was thinking, like, wow, like, I was so young, so I never really asked too many questions, but it must have taken her hours and hours by herself, right? But I do remember the one time that I did go over, I can remember asking her, it must be harder to clean a polar bear skin than a seal skin. And she said right away, no, it's not. So that's what we remembered too when we were cleaning it. Like, no, Nan said, it's not going to be harder than a seal skin, so we're going to be all right.
How have you seen the passing on of this traditional knowledge like this and, you know, skills like this? How has it affected others in your community?
Yeah, so when she used to clean seals, for example, there was one hunter that she would clean the polar bear skins for, but then he started going to her house when she was cleaning the skin and he was learning from her. And then, you know, when she got so much older, she would tell the hunters, if you're going to kill the bear, you got to learn how to clean it yourself because I'm getting old. So that's when the hunters, they started to learn how to clean it themselves. And now they clean it themselves because they learn from her. You can see there it's like passing on of that knowledge. And now they're getting older. So we thought, you know, if people are still going to hunt bears, somebody has to clean the skin, right? So that's why we wanted to do it as well. And hopefully by us, the younger generation, doing it and having it there by our shed, you know, it can show other people too that, you know, it doesn't really matter how young or old you are. Like, anybody can learn. And it's important to carry on the traditions because if the bear is going to be killed, the skin has to be cleaned.
Mm-hmm. Why is it important for you and your brother to pass on these traditional skills to young people and community members?
I think culture and language, it's so important because it's who we are, you know, and you got to know where you came from in order to know where you're going. And I've always said it's like, it's not learning something new, it's just reawakening what's already inside. It's something that everybody yearns for and wants, you know, language and culture. And if we in our own little way somehow can be a means to providing this support to people in the community, that makes us feel good, that makes people feel good. And that's what it's all about, you know. That's all we're trying to do, is just help people find a means to connect.
Amazing. So now the big question everybody probably wants to know is, like, what are you going to do with the polar bear skin now that you finished?
Well, after it's done drying on the frame, I think what we're going to do is take it off, and probably we have a tent set up by our house for programming in the community. So we'll probably put it in there for sitting on. And if we get to build an igloo, then we could put it in there. And I think what the plan is if we clean another polar bear skin next year, then this first polar bear skin, we will have it for programming for people to use for sewing materials. So we'll let people cut it up and use what they need.
Are you going to try and do that again? Are you going to clean another polar bear skin?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind doing it again. I think my brother would be up for it again. But again, once a year. Once a year is good. That's enough.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You're going to become the resident polar bear skin cleaner.
Hopefully other people can learn too, and then there'll be a bunch of us.
Yeah. What do you think your nan would say about, you know, that you've taken on this role?
She'd probably say, I don't know. I'd say she'd be pretty proud of what we're doing. And, I wish she was here to give us some tips and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
We learned as much as we could when she was here. And we did learn a lot. And she is a big reason for our success in what we're doing so far. If it wasn't for her, we wouldn't be here doing this. So yeah, I'd say she'd be pretty happy with what we're doing and how we're sharing it too with everyone, because people would go to her, they would go to her house and have a cup of tea and sew and talk and chat and laugh. So if we can pass on that same, the essence of her, if we can pass that on through us, then that's our main goal. And people have come here as well and they say, oh, it feels like going to Aunt Joy's. That's why we're doing what we're doing, to give people a sense of a homey feeling where they can come and be themselves and live well and have a good time and sew and chat and laugh. So that's all we want to do.
So and chat and laugh. I love that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure your nan is looking down at you and going, you missed a spot.
Yeah. Most likely.
Vanessa, thank you so much for sharing this experience with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Vanessa Flowers, Director of Education for Inatsiavik. Vanessa's Inuk from Hopedale, Inatsiavut. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Amanda Gear, and Elena Hudgens-Lyle. You can now listen to us streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchub, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Inanaskimitnawa. Agusei.